crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. At 10:22 a.m. on May 21st, 2026, a medical team at Riverbend Maximum Security Institution in Nashville started looking for a vein. Tony Carruthers was already strapped to the gurney. His attorney, Maria DeLiberato, was in the room, close enough to hear the needles go into the plastic waste bin one after another, close enough to hear the team ask for a bigger gauge and then a smaller one, close enough to hear one of them quietly grunt with the effort of it. By 10:54, DeLiberato checked the clock on the wall. Half an hour had passed. Carruthers' breathing was audibly labored. She asked the warden how long they were going to let this go on. According to DeLiberato, the warden replied, quote, "until they tell me they can't," end quote. In the viewing room next door, the curtain was drawn and the lights were off. That meant that the 7 media witnesses allowed to attend the execution couldn't see any of this, but they could hear it. They heard a doctor tell Carruthers he was about to get a shot of lidocaine, the local anesthetic, ahead of an attempt to place a central line, a procedure normally done in a hospital on someone who isn't strapped down and fighting to breathe. Then they heard DeLiberato ask out loud whether the man attempting it was even qualified. Next, the warden, sounding a bit frazzled at this point, said to the executioner, "Do your job, sir." Just after 11:20, almost an hour into it, they heard Carruthers groan. You might have heard about this case. If you did, chances are you heard it reported about like this.
Tonight, a man scheduled to die by lethal injection walks out of the execution chamber and receives a one-year stay from the governor.
The state called off Tony Carruthers' execution in the final moments after there were issues inserting his IV. Now the state's death penalty system is facing fresh questions.
That makes it sound like they just poked him a couple of times, like when I go to get blood drawn and they tell me my veins are tricky because they're too small. That's not at all what happened here. WKRN's Kelly Milan clarifies.
That's never happened here in the modern era of the death penalty. Tony Carruthers walked out of the execution chamber today after hours of a torturous experience, to say the least. That's unprecedented in Tennessee.
Imagine walking into a room, knowing you're going to die, only to be poked and prodded until your executioner gave up. It's wild to contemplate. And for people who think Carruthers is guilty, maybe they're like, serves him right. What he's accused of doing is even worse. After all, that morning in the execution room, the state of Tennessee was enacting its retribution against him for allegedly kidnapping and killing 3 people in 1994. Marcello Sanderson, Anderson's mother Delois, and Anderson's 17-year-old friend Frederick Tucker. The crime occurred in Memphis, and the motive, prosecutors said, was to seize control of Anderson's drug territory. But Carruthers did not die on May 21st. After the failed execution attempt, Governor Bill Lee, who had denied clemency the day before despite a petition with more than 130,000 signatures, granted a one-year reprieve in a short written statement that gave no clear reason why. Outside the prison gates, where protesters and death penalty supporters had been standing on opposite sides of a police line since before dawn, DeLiberato, his lawyer, came out to tell them what had happened. She was crying as she discussed next steps.
I am so grateful that we are going to have a chance to prove what we've been saying and what Tony has been saying for 30 years, that he didn't commit this crime.
Before we get too deep into this, I'll disclose for transparency's sake that I'm not really a fan of capital punishment. I'm not an advocate against it, but I don't personally agree with it because I don't trust humans to admit when they're wrong, and death is irreversible. After all, my investigative work helped get a man off death row and exonerated of the murder he had been convicted of. Elwood Jones was supposed to have been dead several times over. Despite my personal beliefs, though, I've always been able to cover death penalty cases fairly. I was an Associated Press editor when I oversaw two executions in South Dakota in 2012. South Dakota law requires an AP witness at every execution, and we had two that year, Eric Robert and Donald Moeller. I watched the family of murdered 9-year-old Becky O'Connell express relief that her killer was permanently unable to harm another living soul, and I got teary right along with them. If someone hurt my child, I'd want him off the planet too. In short, I can compartmentalize on the topic. That's what we journalists have to do. But Tony Carruthers' case isn't like the two I covered. He maintains his innocence. And more than that, there's no physical evidence tying him to the case. Because of that, he has a huge swath of supporters who insist that he is factually innocent. Carruthers is 57 years old. He's been on Tennessee's death row for 30 years. On May 21st, he became, by his lawyer's account, the first person forced to represent himself at his own capital trial to reach the death chamber in over a century. It's not clear Tennessee got the right man at that trial. Unclear, too, is whether the state can even carry out the sentence it handed down. Deliberato called the botched execution attempt outright torture.
The V-line in his shoulder was filled with blood, like backfilled towards his chest area, and he said that his chest really hurt. This was a tortured, botched execution. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, I guess it's not an execution because thankfully, by the grace of God, he's still alive, but they tortured him trying to find a vein.
The doctor who spent 90 minutes failing to find a vein in Carruthers' arm is currently at the center of a fight over whether he'll be allowed anywhere near the next man Tennessee tries to execute. As regular listeners know, sometimes in this feed I cover cases that have the hallmarks for eventually qualifying as a crime of the century. It's under that heading that I'm covering this case today. The case against Tony Carruthers might well be a future crimes of the centuries. This bonus episode is to help you understand why. To do that, let's go back 32 years to February 1994. A drug dealer named Marcellus Anderson, his mother, Delois, and Anderson's 17-year-old friend, Frederick Tucker, disappeared from Delois' home in Memphis. Delois had last been seen about 7:15 p.m. on February 24th when she dropped off a coworker. Later, her niece and roommate, Leventhia Briggs, arrived at their shared home at about 9 p.m. and was concerned because Delois wasn't there, but her car, keys, and purse were. Briggs also found half-eaten food in Delois' bedroom, suggesting that her aunt had been interrupted mid-meal. That pointed to a sudden and forced abduction. Prosecutors soon had a theory. They thought that whoever kidnapped Delois had gone there looking for her son and his drug money. When they found only her, prosecutors posit that they forced her at gunpoint to call her son and lure him to her home. Marcellus arrived with friend Frederick Tucker in tow, and the killers kidnapped all three victims, drove them away, and brutally killed them. A week later, all three turned up in a local cemetery, bound and buried together under someone else's headstone. Now, this in and of itself is a bizarre story, so let me explain. Hours before anyone reported the three missing, the Jeep Cherokee that Marcellus had borrowed from his cousin turned up burning in DeSoto County, Mississippi. Family members filed missing persons reports the next morning. Memphis police started by beating the bushes for anyone who might know something. That's how they found Jonathan Montgomery, a young man with his own criminal record, and, as it turned out, a brother, James, who would soon be charged in the case. Now, at this point, police were already suspicious of foul play, but all they really had was a burned-out Jeep and three missing people. Jonathan was about to change that. He told detectives the three had indeed been killed, and he knew where their bodies were. They had been buried under a grave that had just been dug for someone else's funeral, which happened as scheduled the very next day. Police at first didn't believe him. They were skeptical that three bodies could be stacked underneath a coffin that had already been lowered into the ground for a legitimate burial. It sounded unhinged. But after days of Jonathan giving bizarre, meandering statements and with no other leads to go on, detectives decided they couldn't just dismiss what he had been telling them. They handcuffed Jonathan and ordered him to lead them to the grave. Memphis Deputy Chief Walter Winfrey explained to reporters at the time that the shackling wasn't because Jonathan was under arrest, though. He said, quote, "He was that way because he had a history of running from us before," end quote. The grave he led authorities to belonged to a woman named Dorothy Daniels, an indigent woman who had died without family, buried at Rose Hill Cemetery on Elvis Presley Boulevard on February 25th. Note the date. It is the day after Marcellos, Delois, and Frederick disappeared. Daniels had been buried in a proper service with witnesses and everything. On March 3rd, after getting a court order, police exhumed the grave. Beneath Daniels' casket, a simple wooden vault, and under a thin layer of dirt and a sheet of plywood, they found the three bodies. Marcellos and Frederick had been shot. Delois, Marcellos' mother, had suffocated. Within days, police arrested and charged two men, Tony Carruthers and James Montgomery, Jonathan's brother. Jonathan himself wasn't charged. He was the state's star witness, the man whose story, however hard it had been to initially believe, had cracked the case open. And then, Jonathan vanished. More after this break.
This episode of Crimes of the Centuries is brought to you by Squarespace. Some cases fade from headlines, but still reshape laws and society. Whether building a site for a research project, tracking client bookings, or selling services, Squarespace keeps the essentials in one place. Choose a polished template or use Blueprint AI to create a design that fits the work. Built-in tools help manage appointments, invoices, online payments, and email campaigns. Analytics show where visitors come from and how they engage, so business decisions rely on more than guesswork. That means more time for the work that matters, whether serving clients or sharing expertise through video. A professional website can make that work easier to find. Head to squarespace.com/launch for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code LAUNCH to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Just as prosecutors were getting their case together in a high-profile triple homicide, their star witness, Jonathan Montgomery, disappeared. And with him went prosecutors' hopes to try Carruthers and James Montgomery, at least at first. A judge dismissed the murder charges against both men. The victims' families were furious. Frederick Tucker's father stood outside that courtroom saying the system had failed him and asking who was going to stop this from happening again. It took until early April for police to catch up with Jonathan Montgomery. He had fled to Milwaukee, traveling, it turned out, with a woman who was also a witness in the case, moved there by her own father around the same time Jonathan disappeared. We don't know if they had moved there together, to be clear. We just know they were found together. By the time Milwaukee police picked him up, Jonathan Montgomery wasn't a witness anymore. Now, he was a suspect. Investigators told reporters that they had turned up documents suggesting he hadn't just led them to the grave, he may have masterminded the killings in the first place. A Shelby County grand jury indicted all three men, Carruthers, James Montgomery, and Jonathan Montgomery, on first-degree murder charges. As you can tell, this case was already wild from the start. I've covered crime in four states, including the better part of a decade in Detroit. I've seen dismemberments, bodies burned in backyard grills, a beheading by sword on a bus one time. I've never seen multiple murder victims uncovered in someone else's grave. No doubt it's not the first time it's happened, but it's fair to say it's unusual. Also, I want to note that while a lot of the coverage of this in recent years has been about Carruthers, and the victims have been summarized as basically drug war casualties, people loved and missed them. Hundreds turned out for their funerals. Marcellos, Delois, and Frederick were eulogized together in a joint service at N.J. Ford & Son's funeral home. The minister who spoke, the Reverend James Boone, told the room that only God knew what had really happened and that people speculating about why these three were killed should, in his words, mind their own business. He was responding in part to television coverage that had already started framing the deaths as gang-related. Frederick Tucker's father pushed back on that. Andre Steele told reporters his son wasn't in a gang, hadn't robbed anybody, hadn't killed anybody, and asked people covering the story to check the facts before repeating rumors. It's easy, 30 years later, for a case like this to flatten into a story about the man on death row. When Carruthers' story is covered by the media nowadays, his guilt or innocence is basically the whole conversation. But Marcellos, Delois, and Frederick were three very real people with a family standing outside a courtroom demanding answers and a room full of mourners who showed up for them. Delois was 43 years old and worked in accounting at National Bank of Commerce. She left behind two sisters and a brother. Her son, nicknamed Cello, was her only child. He was 21 years old and had a son of his own whom Delois adored. Cello had a brother on his father's side. Frederick Tucker left behind his mother, a father, a sister, and two brothers. Whatever else this case turns out to be about, it started with them. Now, this case took a while to reach trial, which shouldn't surprise you, but this one, again, has more twists and turns than I could have imagined. And by the way, the summaries of the case that I've seen published recently don't mention half of the craziness I found in the trial coverage from the time. Let's get to it. By the time Tony Carruthers went to trial, 2 years had passed since the bodies came out of that grave. That, in theory, should have been enough time to make the case airtight. Instead, what actually happened in those 2 years is its own story of a justice system buckling under pressure. Some of it seems, deliberately applied. Let's start with the numbers. Carruthers went through six, count them, six, court-appointed attorneys. That's a lot. They all kept quitting. The last one, William Massey, was excused from representing Carruthers after he said that Carruthers, in letters and phone calls, described Massey's daughter's car in detail and told him he had contacts on the outside who did thorough enough work that he would soon know the color of her toothbrush, too. Jail officials searching Carruthers' cell around the same time found surveillance manuals with titles like How to Get Anything on Anybody and How to Tail Anyone Anywhere. I swear, the Four Dummies book series will tackle just about anything. In a letter, Carruthers accused Massey of being racist and working against him. He wrote, quote, "You have 72 hours to withdraw from my case, or I will do what I have to do," end quote. So, shocker, Massey didn't want to represent him anymore. Judge Joseph Daly denied Carruthers' request for a seventh attorney just as the trial was about to start, saying on the record that Carruthers had poisoned his own relationship with every lawyer assigned to him and was, in the judge's words, trying to build error into the case.
"I've tried over and over and over to get lawyers in here for you, and over and over and over, you have succeeded in threatening them, running them away."
Daly had had enough, saying, "Nope, you can't get a seventh lawyer who would inevitably need time to read up on the case file and delay the start of the trial. We've been dragging this out long enough. You'll have to represent yourself." Carruthers seemed happy to oblige. But we all know what they say about lawyers who have themselves as clients, right? Right. Now, I knew about Tony Carruthers' case not only from a few headlines I'd read, but also because he has sent me repeated prompts to accept an invitation to chat through the prison email system. I assume that's because he knows my work through my other podcasts where I investigate wrongful conviction claims. He's got a whole team working for him, though, and I tend to adopt less high-profile cases with fewer resources. I also got emails from Carruthers supporters, so in an exchange with one, I asked about Tony's wild pretrial behavior, what with threatening the lawyers who were there to help him and whatnot. She skillfully evaded the question and just kept telling me Carruthers is innocent. Carruthers himself says the allegations against him were bogus. This is him talking to What the Helly News.
All the attorneys trying to get me to cop out. Then they start pretending like I'm threatening them. So it was a pressure tactic. If you don't cop out, we make you go to trial by yourself.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Carruthers' current legal team doesn't present things that way. They reference that scary pretrial behavior and say it was evidence of an undiagnosed mental illness, brain damage, and a psychiatric disorder that a courtroom in 1996 had no framework for recognizing. Maybe that's true. Regardless, looking at the old reports and records, a lot of people were pretty scared of Carruthers. Not only Carruthers' attorneys, but witnesses too. A key witness, a cousin of the Montgomery brothers, a young woman named Nikita Montgomery, fled to Milwaukee after the killings and ended up hospitalized, heavily sedated, and under suicide watch before she ever took the stand. A prosecutor told the court simply, "She's scared to death." Security around the courtroom became, in the words of one deputy, unprecedented. There were armed officers inside and out. The judge also issued a media gag order over the names of 9 state witnesses that the daily newspaper, The Commercial Appeal, itself had to fight in court to loosen. And then there was Jonathan Montgomery, the younger brother of James Montgomery. He went from star witness to murder suspect in a flash, but he never did face trial. In August 1995, 7 months before jury selection began, Jonathan was found hanged in his jail cell, bedsheets tied together on a wall hook. Authorities said there was no indication of foul play and ruled it a suicide. Now you'll remember, Jonathan was the one who led police to the grave in the first place. He had given conflicting stories to police in 2 states, and after implicating his own brother, he ran. Then he was charged himself. In hindsight, I'm not sure how strong the case against him was. Given the totality of the circumstances, I'm wondering if Jonathan led police to the grave, then got cold feet about testifying against his own brother, and vanished, hoping the whole thing would go away. Initially, it looked like it would. That's why charges were dismissed when he disappeared. But then, prosecutors got a grand jury to indict all 3. My gut? And this is purely speculation, is that they hoped Jonathan would flip and testify against Carruthers and his brother, and he, well, opted not to. Whatever the case, he never got the chance to explain himself in court. He was only 24 when he died. The case moved forward against James Montgomery and Carruthers, who were tried jointly. And we'll talk about that debacle after a short break. The trial against Tony Carruthers and James Montgomery, when it finally happened in 1996, gave jurors a portrait of a Memphis drug economy running on cash, diamond rings, and AK-47s. A jailhouse informant named Chris Hines testified that Jonathan Montgomery had told him directly that they had killed Cello and them at the cemetery and walked away with $200,000. Other witnesses described Marcelo Sanderson keeping $5,000, $6,000, sometimes $10,000 or more in cash in his pocket, his socks, his mother's attic. Prosecutors' theory was that James Montgomery wanted his old North Memphis drug territory back, and that Marcelo's flush, careless with money, an easy target, was in the way. Because Carruthers was representing himself, he was able to cross-examine these witnesses directly. It often went nowhere useful. At one point, questioning a man who claimed to have been shot in a prior incident, Carruthers seemed to be building toward discrediting the witness and instead got the guy to say, on the record, in front of the jury, that some people believed Carruthers himself had been the one who shot him. That pattern, a cross-examination backfiring on the man conducting it, would repeat itself with much higher stakes when Carruthers called a witness named Alfredo Shaw to the stand. Shaw was a career jailhouse informant, someone with a long history of trading testimony for consideration in his own cases. He was part of the evidentiary package presented to a grand jury to secure indictments in the case. He told the grand jury that Carruthers had confessed to him. Before trial, in a television interview, Shaw recanted that story, saying police had pressured and paid him to lie. I found that news story. It's a few minutes long, but worth the listen.
It's a controversial triple murder case, the trial of Tony Carruthers and James Montgomery, and it may get even more controversial in the next week or so. Aside from Carruthers representing himself in this trial, now, one of the state's former key witnesses is about to change his story.
The deposition that was given, Audrey, the statements that were made were coerced. And I would say coerced, I would say that they were, I was given a police report to familiarize some of the things that was in surrounding the case. Some of the things in here is bits and pieces that were put together for the grand jury by the prosecution.
Back in March of 1994, this man, who's asked us not to reveal his name and to photograph him in silhouette, was brought before the grand jury to testify for prosecutors in the case against Carruthers and Montgomery. According to portions of his taped deposition, he told grand jurors about a conversation he had with Carruthers in the Shelby County Jail legal room. Quote, Tony told me that he shot Tucker and Marcellus Bill on the scene immediately, and I said, why did you all burn the truck up, Tony? Carruthers allegedly replied, man, our fingerprints were all over the truck. Well, Tony, why you all killed the woman? Tony said she started hollering and said, James put the pistol up to her head and told her, expletive, or else you're going to die like your dead, expletive son. But when we interviewed this man on February 28th of this year, he told us a different story. This man admits he approached homicide with some information on this case, but then said a prosecutor contacted him.
I was contacted by prosecutor attorney Jerry Harris. And he asked me about the case and asked me, would I be a witness for the state? And I told him, yes, I would. You know what I mean? And then we went on to discuss, you know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? I told him, I asked him, you know what I mean? Well, what's in this for me? You know what I mean? He told me that, you know what I mean? Well, you know you'll get $2,000, you know what I mean, once you testify.
The prosecution did bring this man before the grand jury, but now claims he's not a credible witness.
He's been arrested one time pawning stolen merchandise from a burglary. I'm not going to put that kind of witness on. Mr. Montgomery, Mr. Carruthers, every other defendant in criminal court has got a right to a fair trial. And a person like this who lies and tells us things, not even about that case, but about other things, they're out.
When we asked this former witness why he's coming forward to recant his testimony after 2 years of silence, this was the response we got.
I was made promises to have all my cases dismissed to be a witness in this case.
So in other words, if you fingered Carruthers and the Montgomerys, your cases were going to be dismissed. Is that what was on the table?
Right. The only thing I had to do was go before the courts and testify.
As you can imagine, prosecutors were not happy about this. They decided not to put Shaw on the stand. Had that been the end of it, the jury would have never known a thing about Alfredo Shaw. But Carruthers, representing himself, decided to call Shaw as a witness. He wanted to get Shaw on record recanting in front of the jury, presumably to show that police were trying to railroad him. It backfired spectacularly. In a cross-examination that his own current attorneys describe as catastrophic, Carruthers inadvertently walked Shaw back into repeating the original confession story, the one Shaw had already disavowed on television, this time under oath, in front of the jury that would decide whether Carruthers lived or died. There are two lawyer-related adages that come to mind. The one about a lawyer representing himself having a fool for a client, and also, never put anyone on the stand unless you're sure what they're going to say. Yikes. Now, years and years later, 28 years after the trial, in fact, it would come out that Shaw wasn't just an oft-used informant. He was actually being paid by the state. He'd been a paid informant for the Memphis Police Department since 1986. The Shelby County DA's office not only didn't divulge that, but officials steadfastly denied that Shaw was a paid informant for anybody at any time. Finally, a court order in 2002 explicitly required the state to fess up, but they still maintained they were unaware of him ever acting as an informant. Yet documents eventually showed he received over $9,000 for drug buys and continued to get paid for quote-unquote informant expenses through 1997, both before and after his testimony in the Carruthers case. Tennessee did not confirm that to Carruthers' defense until 2024. But of course, jurors had no way of knowing this. On April 26, 1996, they convicted Tony Carruthers and James Montgomery on three counts of first-degree murder apiece. They were also convicted of especially aggravated robbery and especially aggravated kidnapping. The jury sentenced both men to death. Oh, by the way, one name barely appears anywhere in the coverage of the trial or that verdict, and that's J.C. McGlynn. McGlynn was James Montgomery's attorney. Remember, this was a joint trial. Carruthers represented himself, not Montgomery. McGlynn did that job, so he was there for the whole trial. He gave a closing argument, arguing that the state hadn't proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt. In article after article about this trial, he's quoted exactly once, and when I was writing this script, I couldn't even remember what he said. I figured that was more telling than looking it back up. What strikes me about this setup is that while Carruthers was only representing himself, there's no way his performance didn't spill over onto what jurors thought of Montgomery. If you've never seen a trial with multiple defendants, I can tell you that this is inevitable. One lawyer can be on the ball and sharp as a tack and have his shit totally together, but if the other lawyer is a mess, it reflects on both defendants. I'm surprised the judge okayed Carruthers' self-representation in a dual capital murder case. Whatever chaos Carruthers created, and by every contemporaneous account he created a lot of it, it landed on both men. Not only that, but McGlynn couldn't even wrest media coverage away from Carruthers. He was a scene chewer, just stealing the spotlight. Anyway, the sentences were handed down on May 29th, and it happened somewhere unusual. Rather than risk transporting Carruthers and Montgomery back to Shelby County, the judge, both prosecutors, and both defense attorneys traveled to them, holding the hearing inside Riverbend Maximum Security Institution in Nashville. Carruthers and Montgomery didn't even attend in person. They chose to stay in their death row cells rather than appear. The reason for the odd location? Security concerns. Apparently, there had been some escape attempts by other inmates, and it seems no one wanted to risk anything with Carruthers and Montgomery. At the sentencing, Prosecutor Jerry Harris didn't hold back. He told the court, quote, "I hope we never see another Tony Carruthers or James Montgomery in our county. Their acts have torn our community apart and scared and shocked people beyond belief," end quote. Judge Joseph Daley, adding 120 years to each man's death sentence, on top of three death sentences apiece, called the crime gruesome and appalling, adding, quote, "It's difficult to even think about what took place. There can be no other sentence," end quote. Both men had criminal histories going back to their preteen years. Both had just been paroled on violent offenses when the killings happened. At this point in the episode, I imagine you're wondering what the big deal is about this case. Carruthers and Montgomery sounded like awful people who deserve whatever comes their way. I'm not here to argue against that, but what's as true today as it was 30 years ago is this. Nothing physical has ever tied Tony Carruthers to those murders or to that cemetery. There's no DNA, no fingerprints, and the trial itself was polluted not only by Carruthers' own ridiculous attempt at self-representation, but also by some prosecutor choices that undoubtedly prejudiced jurors. We'll talk about those in a minute.
Some cases become known for changing laws. Others leave a mark because they force people to face hard truths. That search for answers can bring up a lot to process, whether the story is from centuries ago or the stress is happening today. Talkspace makes it easier to care for your mental health with a licensed therapist, psychiatrist, or nurse practitioner in your state. Choose live video, audio, or chat sessions that fit your schedule. Therapy is available every day, at any time, so support can become part of your routine. Plans are flexible, and providers can be changed at no extra cost. Thousands of licensed providers are available across all 50 states. Starting at $69 per week, help can fit your budget, and most insured members receive Talkspace for free. Talkspace is in-network with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off of your first month when you go to Talkspace.com and enter promo code SPACE80. That's SPACE80. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com.
On December 11th, 2000, so less than 4 years after he had been convicted and sentenced to death times three, James Montgomery got some good news. His conviction was reversed. That was a direct consequence of the trial court's refusal to sever his case from Tony Carruthers. The Tennessee Supreme Court ruled that Carruthers' forced representation, because remember, he had requested a seventh court-appointed attorney and was denied one, matched with his highly erratic behavior during the trial, created a pregnant possibility of prejudice that ultimately deprived Montgomery of his right to a fair trial. You gotta appreciate the good alliteration there. Specifically, the court noted that Carruthers' mannerisms, which apparently included a quote-unquote offensive and distracting habit of manipulating his groin in front of the jury, and his inept questioning of witnesses, elicited damaging and incriminating evidence that would likely not have surfaced in a separate trial. Alfredo Shaw's testimony was the most devastating blow. In fact, in the reversal, it was called, quote, some of the most damaging evidence of the entire trial, end quote. Because of all this, Montgomery's convictions were overturned and his case was remanded for a new trial. But he never got one. Instead, Tennessee offered Montgomery a plea deal in 2006. He took it, got a 27-year sentence, and was released in 2015. That was 11 years ago. Carruthers, meanwhile, was literally strapped to an execution gurney a few months ago for the same crime. The conviction against these two guys involved the same set of facts, the same 1994 cemetery, the same alleged plot, and yet one man is free while the other still has a death clock ticking over his head. You might wonder why Tennessee went the plea deal route. That was, in part, because some stuff prosecutors alleged during the trial didn't end up being true. It goes like this. Back when the crime occurred, officials told reporters that while the male victims found in the cemetery had been shot and seriously wounded, none of the victims had been dead before they were buried. All three had been buried alive. This was a central and horrifying component of the prosecution's case, that all three were breathing and conscious when they were placed in a pit beneath a sheet of plywood and covered with dirt. During the trial, the state's star sentencing witness was medical examiner O.C. Smith, who provided vivid and emotionally wrenching testimony regarding the victim's alleged suffering. He opined that Marcellus Anderson, despite a paralyzing neck wound, would have felt the agonizing effects of drowning in his own blood. He said DeLois died from asphyxiation caused by the crushing weight of the dirt and the other bodies on top of her. The prosecution used this narrative as the centerpiece of its argument for the death penalty, successfully convincing the jury that the murders were sufficiently heinous, atrocious, and cruel. But it wasn't true. The narrative was eventually backtracked and debunked through post-conviction proceedings and expert reevaluation. Expert pathologist Dr. Cleland Blake concluded that the two male victims were dead before burial. DeLois was likely either dead or unconscious too. Blake's not alone in his belief. Dr. George Nichols testified there was no physical evidence of conscious activity, no claw marks or anything, and no dirt, mud, or dust in the victim's lungs or upper airways. On top of that, O.C. Smith even recanted his trial testimony in an affidavit, saying he no longer held the opinion the victims were alive when buried. This came out in that six-year period between James Montgomery's conviction being set aside and his plea deal, by the way. Now, this doesn't change the fact that the deaths were horrific and awful and unfathomable, but Carruthers got the death penalty largely because jurors thought his victims died in this specific manner, and it's just not true. And other stuff has come out in the interim, too. Like James Montgomery saying that Carruthers wasn't involved in the murders. In 2010, 16 years after the killings, Montgomery provided a statement to investigators that explicitly exonerated Carruthers. He said he had done it with the help of another man, a guy called Ronnie Eyeball Irving, whom Montgomery described as his quote-unquote kidnap man. Carruthers' legal team has repeatedly referenced Montgomery's exoneration to prove his innocence, including it in a clemency petition and in his federal civil rights litigation seeking a stay of execution. But the Tennessee courts have dismissed its significance, saying in various rulings that even if what Montgomery said about Eyeball Irving were true, it wouldn't be enough to undermine the supposedly overwhelming evidence of Carruthers' involvement. A lot of those rulings reference Alfredo Shaw's testimony as though it's true, even though he was a paid informant who was so unreliable that prosecutors didn't trust him to put him on the stand. In the midst of all of this, by the way, there's unmatched DNA and unmatched fingerprints from the crime scene. They don't match Carruthers, and despite his lawyer's efforts, no one's ever compared them to Irving, who has since died. As Carruthers' sister said,
"The time was right to test those fingerprints and the DNA in 1994 when they discovered the bodies of Marcellus and Dolores and little Fred Tucker. The time was right to test the DNA during the trial in 1996 so that no one would have any ambiguity about what happened to Marcellus, Dolores, little Fred Tucker."
Tennessee courts have refused to compare them repeatedly under the state's Post-Conviction DNA Analysis Act, most recently just before his execution in May 2026. They have given a variety of reasons: that it wouldn't prove Carruthers didn't take part in the crime, that it would cause an unreasonable delay in his execution, that the DNA and fingerprints could have been left by people other than the killer or killers anyway. Whatever the reason, the result each time has been the same. The evidence that might resolve this stays in a box, untested. For what it's worth, Andre Steele, the father of victim Frederick Tucker, believes Carruthers is guilty, but he also isn't banging on anyone's door demanding he be executed either. He told WREG News,
"If Governor Lee feel that he need to do whatever he need to do and they're going to stay the execution or whatever, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it because I know that my God somewhere gonna make judgment on Tony Carruthers. If it's not this year, it'll be before his life is over. He will see his maker."
Now, on a separate note, Carruthers' lawyers are arguing he isn't competent to be executed at all, that the same paranoid delusions and brain damage that may explain his 1996 courtroom behavior now leave him unable to rationally understand why the state even wants to kill him. A Tennessee court found otherwise, ruling he understands both this conviction and the reason for his scheduled execution. Now, of course, none of what I've laid out for you proves Tony Carruthers is innocent, but it does prove that Tennessee has spent 30 years building and defending a death sentence on a foundation it has refused at every turn to actually test. And it highlights a massive discrepancy in two supposed co-conspirators' sentences. One's free, the other's still set to die. By the morning of May 21st of this year, Carruthers had run out of runway.
Governor Bill Lee is not intervening in the pending execution of a man convicted of killing three people in Memphis over 30 years ago.
The governor's office sent this statement to News 2 regarding death row inmate Tony Von Carothers. After deliberate consideration of Tony Von Carothers' request for clemency and after a thorough review of the case, I am upholding
the DNA testing request had been denied. The competency ruling had gone against him. Hours before he was strapped to the gurney, the U.S. Supreme Court denied his application for a stay of execution. The request had gone to Justice Kavanaugh, who referred it to the full court, which denied it. A separate cert petition on the merits of his DNA testing claims was still sitting there, undecided, when the execution proceeded anyway.
All right, we are continuing our breaking news coverage this morning when it comes to the execution, the scheduled execution of Memphis triple murder suspect Tony Carruthers. He was convicted in this triple murder. In just minutes, in the last few minutes, the execution was scheduled to take place. It is happening in Nashville at the Riverbend Maximum Security Institution in Nashville. We are waiting word, official word from the
state. You already know what happened next. Tennessee's Department of Corrections put it in a single clinical sentence like this. Medical personnel had quickly established a primary IV line, but were unable to immediately establish a backup line pursuant to protocol. Here's how Carruthers described what happened.
They had trouble finding the vein. They poked me illegally 3 times in one arm, and then they actually got a vein in the right arm. And then they went to the left arm, and they got it in, but the poison, but they do some kind of test to see if it'll flow, and the poison wouldn't flow.
And by the way, that botched attempt didn't leave Carruthers unscathed.
I got chest pains, and I got weakness in my right arm, and I got a coordination problem with balance.
Carruthers is back in a cell at Riverbend, waiting for a new date that Tennessee hasn't set yet, though under the terms of the reprieve, it will have to sometime next spring. Now, there's one more thing worth knowing. The doctor who spent 90 minutes failing to find a usable vein in Carruthers' arm has a name, Dr. Mark Fowler. He's a Tennessee Department of Corrections contractor, and as of this recording, he's expected to be the same doctor assigned to the state's next scheduled execution, a man named Daryl Hines, set to die on August 13th. Hines's attorneys have gone to court to keep Fowler away from their client, arguing that what happened to Carruthers could happen again. A judge has already ordered the state to disclose ahead of time whether it plans to use him. Hines' case is its own story, with its own complicated legal history, not one we're getting into here. What matters for this one is simple. The failure inside that execution chamber on May 21st didn't stay contained to Tony Carruthers. It's already reaching into the next case, and the one after that will have to reckon with it too. To research this case, I read contemporaneous newspaper coverage, mostly out of the Commercial Appeal in Memphis, along with wire stories from the Associated Press and a handful of other Tennessee papers that covered pieces of this over the years. I also read the actual court record, the Tennessee Supreme Court's opinion in Carruthers' direct appeal, post-conviction filings, and the federal habeas litigation that's still working its way through the courts right now. More recently, I pulled from the ACLU's motions for DNA testing. I also watched some local news footage, some of which you heard clips from. Crimes of the Centuries is a production of Grabbag Collab. To subscribe, go to grabbagcollab.com. This episode was engineered by me,